Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available on iTunes and, like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, it's going to sound like the Blues House Party this week's show. I have something old and something new to share with you. Earlier this week, I got to speak with writer Donald Martin, who is the writer of the film Queen Bees, that is in theaters and streaming now, the one with Ellen Burstyn, Jane Curtin, Anne Margaret, Loretta Devine, James Caan, Christopher Lloyd. It's if you put Mean Girls in a retirement community, I guess, is the pitch on that. He also has a film on Lifetime, one of several, but currently the most recent, Secrets of a Gold Digger Killer. Because Lifetime, they love those titles that just grab you. So anyway, I'll be talking with, you'll hear my interview with Donald in just a little bit, and then we'll dip into the archives. But I'm here to tell you about a couple things I watched recently, just trying to catch up on stuff. It's a travel week at the Soucy household. But I forgot to mention this on the show last week. From Corneth Films is a nice little Italian comedy called Biette. And it's a story of a garment factory, ladies who make lingerie, and they are all laid off via group text message. And their forewoman, Armida, played by Donatella Finocchiario, pardon my Italian, wind up going into business for themselves. There's been some comparisons to The Full Monty or Calendar Girls as far as trying to maintain a living, making something for themselves, a little bit of girl power, and, yes, having to do some modeling on their own. So, but it's a fun little dessert of a film, and yeah, so check that out. It's called Biette, and it's on Corneth Films, Corneth Home Video. And I finally finished the very cool box set from Arrow Home Video, Weird Wisconsin, the Bill Rabane Collection. And this has several of his films. I'd love to see some more of them, but you know, they range from Monster a Go-Go to The Alpha Incident. And there's a really cool documentary about Bill called Who is Bill Rabane? And it's not just his story, but it's also kind of the champion of regional filmmaking, or even some cases, state filmmaking. And since Bill Rabane shot, I think, all of his films in Wisconsin, they have a very Wisconsin feel. And at one time, kind of like wrestling territories, there were filmmaking territories back when I was a kid. And it talks about his own, it has his own little studio. And just like George Romero had the Pittsburgh area, Bill Rabane had the Wisconsin area. Going through his life story a little bit, from Lithuania, wound up in Wisconsin, made a short film of a band playing, which got picked up by American International Pictures to pad one of their films, and almost got a film deal there. And also wound up shooting some stuff that Herschel Gordon Lewis wound up finishing that became Monster a Go-Go. But over time was able to make films like The Giant Spider Invasion, which was Mystery Science Theater fodder, The Alpha Incident, which was on this collection, The Capture of Bigfoot, Rana. A lot of show don't tell. Although there's a lot of talking in his films as well. But anyway, it was just a fun look at the guy who was able to carve out a career and not have to go to Hollywood. There's titles like Miracle on a Manger with Donald O'Connor. There is one horror film with Tiny Tim, not making it up. You have to look for it. It's not in the collection, but you should. Blood Harvest. But yeah, it's just a fun look at one guy's dream of making movies, and he was able to do it. We should all be so lucky. So salute to Bill Rabane and the collection Weird Wisconsin, the Bill Rabane Collection. It is available on Blu-ray from Arrow Video. Go look for it. Make a great gift. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Oh, a couple other nuggets, I'm sorry, before I get into the interview of Bill Rabane. Also in this collection were a couple of his short films. One was The Twist Craze, followed by The Dance Craze, and then a 1973 instructional short on what happens if you are a victim of a kidnap extortion. And I forgot that The Alpha Incident, one of his mid-70s epics, was often on the same double feature as Star Wars. And it got to follow Star Wars, so take that for what it is. Anyway, once again, Weird Wisconsin, the Bill Rabane Collection, limited edition Blu-ray, courtesy of Arrow Video. Now, you're still listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Friends, here's my chat with writer Donald Martin. We talk about queen bees. We talk about secrets of a gold digger killer, being a journalist, as well as a screenwriter. Well, a former journalist and now a screenwriter, and some other tidbits and nuggets of fun. Here's my chat with Donald Martin. Enjoy. Well, Donald, congratulations on Queen Bees. What were your thoughts about the film?
Oh, I enjoyed it very much, and I thought it has rolled out very nicely. You know, it's rare these days for a film in the feature film marketplace to start small and build. They used to call it a platforming kind of release. And, you know, that almost seems old-fashioned now when you have major blockbusters, you know, costing over $200 million and having to make $200 million on their opening weekend. Here we have a film, much more modestly budgeted, that started with 500 cinemas, is now at 600 cinemas, and is growing to 700 and 800. And the word of mouth has been absolutely wonderful. You know, I wrote this project with little tidbits of my mother sprinkled within each of the queen bees. So it was a labor of love for me. And I'm just so pleased to see that it's being embraced both by critics and by the public.
Yep. And on a side note, you also have one of the more fascinating social media characters going on, and that's James Caan.
Yes, James Caan is a very interesting man and a very good actor.
Well, I believe he was referred to as like everyone's social media grandpa because it's the same type of tweet every time. But that's James being James, apparently.
You know, the interesting thing about this movie is when the producers first approached me, Harrison Powell, he is with Astute Films in Los Angeles, and they reached out to me because I have a longstanding relationship with Dominique Telson, who's the head of development and production of Astute Films. Mm-hmm. And we had made a number of projects together when she was at Showtime, and I was writing some movies for Showtime. And Harrison's grandmother, she lost her husband, and she went into a senior citizens community. And to her surprise, she met someone, fell in love, and had what's called an encore marriage. So that inspired him, and he came up with a story that they presented to me and said, you know, what do you think? Come back to us with a pitch. So I regaled them with stories of my mother, which were a little juicier and a little more risque than what his grandmother was going through. But we kind of wove those together, and I never told anyone this, I secretly wrote the lead role with Ellen Burstyn in my head. Mm. As a writer, I always try to picture an actor or an actress who's going to inhabit a role, whether they end up playing it or not. It helps me as a writer find the character's voice and to find how they move and how they behave. So it was such a delight, an absolute dream come true for me when Ellen Burstyn read the script and loved it and said yes. And when we were shooting in Atlanta, I went on set for a period of time and I met with her and I told her the secret. I said, you know, I wrote this for you. And she was quite touched because I guess no one had ever written a script for her before.
Oh, wow.
Which I find difficult to believe.
Yeah.
She is one of the best actors of our generation. But she's delightful in person, and as the character of Helen, I absolutely love her.
Has this, now you mentioned that, you know, this worked out in this case. Looking at your previous credits, has that ever happened before as far as writing with somebody in mind and they wind up getting in?
Yes, yes, a few times. Or I've been approached by people like Robert Urich when I wrote some of his Spencer for Hire movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that I was writing specifically for him. But when I did the CBS movie Family Sins that Kirstie Alley ended up starring in, a Sunday night movie for CBS back in the early 2000s, I did write it with her specifically in mind. And I had told the producers that, and therefore they went out and made an offer to her, and she embraced the role and inhabited it really, really well. It kind of revived her career, because at the time, if you recall, she was Kirstie Alley, who was overweight mm-hmm. and wasn't really getting hired. But this role called for someone
mm-hmm.
who was overweight, and it's one of those incredible but true crime stories that you simply cannot make up. And it was one of the highest rated movies in 2004. And while on set, because she enjoyed working so much again, she came up with the idea of her Showtime series, Fat Actress. So it was an interesting sort of path to getting that Showtime series on the air.
And you said earlier that each of the queen bees have an old trait from your mother. Could you share that with us?
Well,
can you clean it up? I guess.
Can I clean it up? Well, yes. Let me just say that Anne Margaret's amorous character is quite reflective of my mother's dating life.
Okay.
And Jane Curtin's rigid card playing rules is very reflective of my mother's card playing rules. And Loretta Devine's sort of easygoing, let's party manner is very much reflective of my mother. And Ellen Burstyn's character, loving to quote people, authors, and being, you know, somewhat, let's say, intransigent on certain issues, very fiercely independent, that's very much my mother.
Okay. Now, I know there's been a lot of comparisons to Mean Girls because of the clique aspect of the film. Were you able to base some of your own high school moments and incorporate those into the film?
No, not necessarily mine, but, you know, I've been around enough high schools and high school students and several of my friends. I'm the one who, you know, I'm the shoulder to cry on, either for the parents or for the kids, for what they're going through in high school. So I took it from there. And, you know, one of the statements we had as a development team going forward when we decided to pursue this as a screenplay and then as a movie was that 80 is the new 18. And, you know, there is some truth to that because I did my research. And before writing the script, I did quite a bit online research. And the number one place for STDs in America is in the retirement community.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because of the invention of Viagra, of course, which has changed all rules and all sorts of things. So because no one is using condoms, and it's because women outnumber the men by a ratio 10 to 1. So in Queen Bees, you see Anne Margaret's character, Margot, deal with Christopher Lloyd's character in such a manner, in that she has him on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, while other women have him on, you know, Thursdays and Saturdays and Sundays. And but the problem is that, you know, if someone has an STD, you know, if Margot were to have an STD, then, you know, the ladies on Thursday and Saturday would also have an STD. So we thought that there was both some interesting drama to be mined there, but we also thought there was some humor to be mined there. Mm-hmm. And it is very adolescent behavior.
You mentioned, in a good way. No, I know. you mentioned earlier visiting the set. When was the shot, and was it was this pre or affected by COVID?
Yes, it was shot before COVID.
Okay.
In Atlanta, and the anticipation on all of our parts was that it would be launched in 2020 for Mother's Day. That was our big plan.
Right.
You know? But we all know what happened in 2020. Nothing. the world stopped. So we all had to sort of regroup and figure out, you know, how to launch a film like this in a pandemic. And I think waiting until we did was the smartest thing to do, because cinemas are opening up again, people are venturing out again, and there is less of a shock to the system, less of a fear that permeates society because of the vaccinations. So I think we timed it very well, just in terms of when to release it. And I think the distribution company and Universal Pictures is really doing a very good job in promoting this.
From a writer, is there a difference in adapting someone's work as far as approaching or outlining compared to an original piece?
Yes, there is. You do want to honor original insights, the person's original idea, which I believe I did, and I worked very closely with Harrison Powell, and he was very much part of the development process, giving me feedback on the outline, on the drafts. I didn't want to create his grandmother, because I had never met his grandmother. And she's not, you know, though she's the inspiration for him coming up with the original idea for the story, she is not necessarily the inspiration for Ellen Burstyn's character. I created that character, you know, through a process of research and knowledge and other people I've known. So I try always to do very, very deep character biographies. And I shared them with the producers. I wanted them to know who Helen was in her youth and why she started ballroom dancing with her husband. I wanted them to know why Margot did not have any kids and why she had five husbands. You know, so I really went quite in depth, which I do in all of my work. And I think it helps the actors as well, because it allowed the actors to share some of their own development, because every actor, you know, develops a backstory for a character. And we were able to discuss that on.
It was
something that helped create stronger characters.
And it does more than just have old people be feisty kind of vibe. That's low-hanging fruit. I mean, there's
that's
more.
Right. Yeah.
So I know you. I know you're also a former journalist. How are deadlines still with you?
Well, you know, journalism taught me a lot about writing. It taught me about efficiency of words. It taught me how to get to the point clearly and concisely when telling a story. We call it a log line in a movie. You know, you call it the lead in a newspaper story. But it's how to entice and seduce an audience. So that was one thing that journalism was a gift for me as a screenwriter. Mm-hmm. In terms of deadlines, yes, I had to deliver something every day by 6 p.m. and it had to be brilliant. So, you know, even when I'm writing something speculatively on my own, I give myself deadlines. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps, because if you don't, you could just sort of keep on developing and keep on developing. Now, it doesn't mean that you stop developing once you meet a deadline, but once you meet a deadline, you then have to show it to people and get feedback, which is a very important part of the process of developing a script.
Yes. And was there overlap time from your journalism years to your screenwriting years?
No, I'll tell you what happened, and this is a long time ago, in 1988. I was writing for the Globe and Mail newspaper in Toronto, and I had always wanted to be a screenwriter, but I didn't know what door to open, if you will. I thought that there was some magic door, and I didn't know where that door was. So I had a friend who was a cinematographer, and he and I talked about, you know, we're going to form a production company, we're going to make movies, we're going to do this. He wanted to be a director, I wanted to be a screenwriter. And every weekend we would talk about it, but we wouldn't necessarily do anything about it. And then he got liver cancer and he died. The Wednesday that he died, the Wednesday morning, I saw him in the hospital, and he grabbed me by the shoulders and said, shut up and write. Stop talking about writing and go and write. So I came home that Friday, and you don't argue with people when they're dying on their deathbed. You just go, of course. So I got home that Friday night, and I had never written a screenplay in my life. I started writing Friday night, Saturday, Saturday night, Sunday, Sunday night. At 2 a.m. Monday morning, I had completed my first screenplay. And ironically, I sold it that Monday to a producer-director, a female producer-director in Toronto, that I had written about twice for the newspaper. And I knew that she was a very adamant, feminist, loving women's stories, wanting to sort of push the envelope on women's stories. And what I had written was, it turned out to be, the very first story about AIDS and HIV written from the point of view of a woman. And she was able to have that movie financed within 2 weeks. And within 6 months, the movie was having its world premiere at the Monte Carlo Television Festival, and Prince Albert gave me the Red Cross Award. And then the World Health Organization invited the film to open the 5th International AIDS Conference, because unbeknownst to any of us, the scientific community was looking at women as the next wave in the story of HIV and AIDS. And so this movie called No Blame, starring Helen Shaver, arrived at the right time. And it changed my entire life and career, because I was offered a 5-picture deal by ABC Pictures, and I stopped writing for the newspaper.
What is the one coverage in the newspaper business? What was the one piece of coverage you liked doing the least?
Well, when they made me go and review plays or films, you know, I initially in the entertainment department, but then I was moved into the entertainment department, and I had to go and be a critic. And as someone who wanted to be creating my own work, I really didn't want to criticize other people's work. So that was the most challenging part for me.
Okay. Coming back to the present, how was your writing during COVID, during the lockdown?
Well, I was fortunate in the sense that I had a number of projects that had begun prior to the lockdown and to the pandemic. So I simply stayed in my home, which is where I 90% of my life anyhow, like most writers, a cave. So I just spent 100% of my time living in a cave, and I just kept on working and revising and rewriting and fine-tuning those scripts. The irony is that here we are in 2021, and I have what may be five films being released in 2021.
I have your IMDb page up, actually. I was going to ask you about these to see if these were true or not. So
let me
start. The Disappearance of Mrs. Wu is completed. Is that correct?
It is completed, and it's a small independent film. It's having its world premiere at Gina Davis's Bentonville Film Festival in August. And that will be officially announced soon, so you're the first to hear it.
Thank you.
That was shot just prior to the pandemic, and it's something I did with Anna Chi. Anna Chi and I together, we did a movie for HBO called Dim Sum Funeral, and we've done some projects together throughout the years for Miramax and the Weinstein Company. And she directed this. We wrote it together. And I'm very proud of it. It's a beautiful, beautiful film, independently financed. And then there's Queen Bees, of course.
Yeah.
And then on the same weekend that Queen Bees came out, my Lifetime movie, Secrets of a Gold Digger Killer, came out on Sunday with Julie Benz. And I did not come up with the title. But here's the irony. I had written that script in 2010. And during the pandemic, every broadcaster was looking for, what do we have that's available, that's already been developed? Like, what can we go, you know, and make? So they made that movie in December of 2020 in British Columbia and Texas, and it's pretty magic. The magic of cinema is amazing, the magic of television, because you would never know where it was shot in Victoria, British Columbia. And it's done very well in the ratings, and so that was sort of a double whammy that weekend. And then I have a Netflix movie starring Alyssa Milano that is now in post-production. It's called Deadly Desire.
Yep, that's on here.
It's based on the Nora Roberts novel, Brazen Virtue, which I don't even know what Brazen Virtue really means, but that novel came out in the late 1980s, and it's a murder mystery taking place in the world of telephone sex. So when Netflix approached me, you know, we obviously wanted to find a more contemporary world to have the story unfold, and so now it takes place in the world of online S&M.
Okay.
And Alyssa Milano is fantastic in the lead. She's a wonderful actress, and I'm very excited about that. And currently, this is not listed on my IMDb, but I'm currently writing a Hanukkah movie for Hallmark Channel, which would, I believe, be the very, very first 100% Hanukkah movie for a U.S. network. Because often, if you pay attention, you know, many of these Christmas stories have a little bit of Hanukkah woven in there, and a little bit of Hanukkah woven in there. This is like Hanukkah all the way.
That's a good title.
So I'm currently writing it. I mean, I'm going to get a green light because it's got, you know, a production date all set up. And so that would be released on Hallmark in December. So that would make the fifth movie of 2021.
Okay. There's two other titles I see. One is called Implant.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And the other...
That is a project. Yeah. That is a project that I've developed with for two female producers who are both deaf. We wanted to create a project that featured central characters who were deaf, and that was not seen as an adversity, but it was seen as an asset and as a strength.
Okay.
So that project is still in development and is in the financing stages. And I don't know what else is on IMDb.
Bear Season.
Oh, Bear Season, of course. Bear Season. Bear Season is written. And J. Todd Harris, who is a wonderful producer, he was one of the producers on the trial of Chicago 7. He is one of the executive producers of 12 Mighty Orphans, which is now mm-hmm. out in cinemas, competing with Queen Bee's. and he also did The Kids Are All Right, one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
And so he is producing this adaptation of a novel called Bear Season. And we've attached Luke Evans, Jacob Tremblay, and Olga Kurylenko. Mm. And the hope is to shoot this film in the spring/summer of 2022. We had hoped to be shooting it in the summer of 2021, but, you know,
right.
the pandemic and all the protocols all over the world and people's schedules and you know, some actors simply refusing to leave their home countries to go to another country to shoot a movie. So we've tabled that. J. Todd Harris is one of the finest producers in Los Angeles, and he has such good taste. And I'm an executive producer on that project as well as the writer. I optioned the book, and I wrote the script on spec because I loved it so much. And, you know, it's the story of a boy, an 11-year-old boy, his inebriated uncle, and a bear that may or may not exist. And the need to believe in something. That's really what it's about. And if you loved Cinema Paradiso, if you loved My Life as a Dog,
yep.
it's that kind of movie.
Okay.
And it's a real passion. It's a real passion project for me. And the bear is actually real. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Bojack, the soldier bear, but
yeah.
this is a novel that weaves in an actual bear who was a corporal in the Polish Freedom Army in World War II.
Okay.
And that bear existed until 1963 at the Edinburgh Zoo. He drank beer, he smoked, and ate lit cigarettes. He wrestled, and he participated in a campaign against the Nazis in Italy in World War II and carried the missiles, bombs to put in cannons. And he helped win the war in Italy against the Nazis. This is all true. I'm not making any of this up.
Okay. Wow. Actually, I was thinking, have you received resumes and headshots from the bear from the David Mamet film, The Edge?
Well, you know, because we are going to spend most of the movie not knowing if this inebriated uncle, who lies all the time, is telling the truth or not, but both he and his nephew like to draw, we are going to use pencil sketch animation whenever we see, quote, flashbacks of the bear in World War II. And therefore, it allows us to doubt the existence of the bear, because even the boy doubts the existence of the bear. And it's only until they reach a critical point in the story that the boy discovers the bear really does exist and that his uncle is the man who took care of the bear from cubhood on and fought next to him in World War II and is the one who had to place him in the Edinburgh Zoo and it made a hole in his heart. So it's kind of a road trip. This 11-year-old boy is going to take his uncle without passports across an ocean into Liverpool and all the way up to Edinburgh so that he can be reunited with his soulmate, the bear.
And the bear will want the and credit.
So we will only see the bear at the very, very end of the movie
mm-hmm.
When they're at the Edinburgh Zoo.
Very good. So you mentioned earlier, well, hey, that's showbiz. You mentioned earlier the fact that you had one of your films one of your scripts on TV and one in the theaters. What is the most number of times where, or the most number of films have been on television at the same time?
Well, I would say because I've written a lot of Hallmark Christmas movies, maybe like 10 of them, they all seem to air in that countdown to Christmas that Hallmark does. So if you want to have a little bit of a Donald Martin festival, you just have to look the Hallmark schedule on my IMDb page, and you can tick them all off, and you can watch them.
Have you ever had two in a row on when they do those marathons?
Three?
Okay.
Three, yes. You... Operation Christmas, Christmas Homecoming, and Christmas Town.
Well, then you need a TCM-like desk to talk and intro these. Go ahead.
No, I just love writing, you know, and I mean, I've been doing this nonstop, and I've been so lucky and blessed since 1988 when I did that first movie. Since then, I've never not been under contract, so I'm always working on something for someone. Plus, I'm always creating my own material.
Excellent.
Like Bear Season, you know, something that I'm always looking for new material and creating stuff on my own. So, and I intend to continue doing this until I'm older than Ellen Burstyn.
Very good.
And I'm not anywhere near there.
Good, good. Hey, when you're writing, are you able to watch a film that's in the same genre or same subject matter, or is that distracting?
No, it's not distracting. I can watch something that's in the same wheelhouse, and I can learn from it. You know, sometimes I intentionally watch films that are in the same wheelhouse because I want to see, all right, what did they do that worked, mm-hmm. and what did they do that didn't work, in my estimation. So I find it helpful. It's part of my research.
Okay. I want to thank you again for your time. Of course, Queen Bees and Secrets of a Gold Digger Killer. You know, certain channels, they got to have the titles that pull you. So, and that has that. So,
yes, it does.
It's kind of like
it's part of Lifetime's Secrets of Summer series. They just brought a bunch of movies that they've made together, and they've added the word secrets to them all. So it's Secrets of Summer. It's a package.
Very good. Hey, but wrap things up. I know they both passed away recently, but do you have stories about Olympia Dukakis or Cloris Leachman?
Oh, yes. I did a movie many, many, many years ago in 1995 with both of them starring in it called Never Too Late.
Genie-nominated Never Too Late.
Yes, yes, and for nominated for Writers Guild of Canada Award as well. And Olympia Dukakis was an absolute genteel, you know, very proper woman. I mean, she just approached everything with such elegance, and you know, of course, she had the mouth of a trucker, but she had also sort of this way about her that was just so poised and elegant. And then you had Cloris Leachman, who was playing at that time her first lesbian role. She played a lesbian in a wheelchair. And she, I guess as part of her research, on set, she decided to grope all the female crew and to flash her breasts at everyone. But that was part of her sort of crazy approach to getting into character. And I have to say, if anyone is able to watch that film, she steals every scene. She's brilliant, Cloris Leachman. I mean, Olympia is a goddess. I love her. But I mean, Cloris was phenomenal in that movie.
Excellent. Well, the film is called Queen Bees. It is written by Donald Martin, who also wrote Secrets of a Gold Digger Killer. Donald, I guess I want to ask, what films have you watched recently? And old, new, or doesn't matter?
Well, I mean, I just watched Kevin Hart's Fatherhood. And I was really pleasantly surprised by how wonderful he is and how well constructed the story was. You know, I mean, he does fairly broad comedy, and so I didn't know what to expect, but I have to say it's a beautiful movie. And it was very special. I watched it on Father's Day.
Oh, perfect. So, all right, well, Donald, I really, really appreciate your time. Congratulations with the projects, and here's to more projects in the future.
Thank you.
That's Donald Martin, the writer of Queen Bees, which is now in theaters as well as streaming, as well as Secrets of a Gold Digger Killer, which is available on Lifetime. Look up his work. You've seen his work in one way, shape, or form. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. I said something old and something new. We're going to dip into the archives. We're going to go to a chat I did in September of 2009 with Academy Award-winning actor F. Murray Abraham, who at the time was in town to do a narration, a dramatic reading, and with the backed up by the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. And this was one of the first major interview elephants I was able to bag and add a somewhat legitimacy to this program. So here's my epic chat with F. Murray Abraham. Enjoy.
Well, what's on your mind?
Well, first off, I guess I should. How should I address you?
Your Majesty.
My liege, I was thinking, but.
My name is. I'm half Syrian, half Italian, and it's hard to please both sides of the family. So my father's name is Frederick, and my name is Frederick, but I decided to use an F because the Syrians call me Farid, and the Italians call me Federico. So with the F, I pleased everybody.
All right, so F. Murray.
That's fine. Murray is just dandy.
Murray, okay.
And how do I call you?
Matthew.
Okay, Matthew.
And so obviously you played a lot of Wasp, obviously, with your background.
I played a lot of Wasp. Yeah, I don't think I ever played a Wasp in my life.
How did you get hooked up with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra?
I've been doing this for years, all over the world.
This particular piece?
And I think that this particular piece, you know what we're doing, right? The Copland piece?
Lincoln's Portrait.
Yeah, it's just, it's very meaningful to me. And the first time I ever did it was here in town with the New York Philharmonic. And I was carried away. I really was very moved by that, by those words. And I had done some studying. I had played a Lincoln once, believe it or not, speaking of Wasps.
A Continental?
A Continental Lincoln? No. Hey, you know, that was a great-looking car.
Yes, it was.
A wonderful car at one time.
Back when cars were a piece of art.
Well, yeah, you're talking to a car fiend. I agree with you. When you could we could spot cars by the sound of their mufflers. They were that individual. I don't know if you know that.
I grew up in an automotive town up in Michigan, so yeah, I remember those days.
Where were you, around Flint?
Yes, I grew up in Flint. Got out with all my fingers.
Yeah, well, my people were steel workers in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
We made the steel that, I don't know, you have your own steel mills in Indiana, I know that.
Well, not really. Gary's a wasteland nowadays.
Well, have you been to Flint lately?
Yes.
I mean, it's really too bad. It's a depressing thing. A friend of mine who lives there, when I did a concert in Detroit, it was one of these concerts, only this was an interesting concept. A concert, it was I'm trying to think. It was, you know Stravinsky's Story of a Soldier.
Yes.
Rather, his music for it.
Right.
Well, Vonnegut has written an adaptation. He said that the original story has nothing to do with reality. He said the music does, the discordant, the wonderful, driving, strange, and absolutely brilliantly original music. I worship Stravinsky. This is a tough piece of literature and writing. He hated war, Vonnegut did.
Mm-hmm.
And it's extraordinary. I don't know why it's not done more often instead of the original. But I was doing it in Michigan, and a friend of mine took me out for a ride out by the lake to have a nice fish dinner. And I saw all those beautiful mansions, all for sale.
Yeah. Now, how often do you get to do pieces like this with symphonies?
Well, it's whenever I get calls, and if I'm not making a flick, if I'm not doing a play, I jump at the chance because I don't know how to explain it. If you have a chance to be on the stage with an orchestra, you have to do it. You have to arrange it with, if you have any pull anywhere, just to be on the stage with them while they're working out.
Now, is this a piece where it's in between the songs, or they're playing under you as you're reading?
It's going to be between and during.
Ooh.
It's just thrilling.
That's got to be a rush.
Oh, I can't begin to tell you. And I've worked with some of the greatest in the world. And it's thrilling. I mean, really thrilling. It's like a different kind of a thrill, because it's not an intellectual activity. It's far beyond it's really deeply, it's visceral, but at the same time, it's transporting. It's transcending. Great.
Well, it's interesting, because when you do a film, unless the director pumps music onto the set during a shot, I mean, that's one thing. But to be able to have, I mean, the soundtrack is behind you.
Yeah, the only problem with it, I mean, the danger, not the problem, is that if you miss your cue, you're in trouble, because the orchestra doesn't try to vamp and catch up. It's hard to do with 90 pieces,
it's,
you know.
It's not a jazz combo.
It's great. It's also a completion of sorts in terms of an actor, because there are things that an actor in the classical works, for example, any Shakespeare, any musical piece of work, Molière, for example, or even some of the beautiful music that's in Tennessee Williams, you're never going to be able to achieve what music achieves. You try to, vocally and also spiritually, but you can't accomplish what Mozart does. It's just a different thing. But the idea that you can combine them, it's a kind of a gift, I must tell you. It's like a little present. And the whole thing is, I'm sure, because I did that movie so many years ago, Amadeus.
25.
I mean, can you imagine? That thing is still alive. People still love it.
Yes, I can, actually. I was 14 when that film came out. I remember being the youngest one in the theater by about 30 years. And not only did this film introduce me to and open my mind to classical music, but I went, wow, who is this guy? You know, the guy from Animal House is great, but who's him? Who is he? And that was, for a lot of people, that was the world introduction to F. Murray Abraham.
Yeah, it was a treat. It was a gift. The problem is, of course, it's not being able to do another one like it, you know?
No Amadeus 2, the final years.
Well, my son said that there should be a sequel where Amadeus is where Mozart's son grows up and wants revenge. He wants to call it Amadambo. Anyway,
don't give Michael Bay any ideas. Now, when you filmed that, did you do the young Salieri first or the old one first?
The old one. I did all the old stuff first. We did it in 3 weeks.
Wow. How much time on the chair for makeup?
4 hours, 4.5 hours each morning.
Were you able to sleep?
Well, I was pretty intense. I don't know how to tell you. I'm a pretty intense actor anyhow, but I was completely dedicated to that, and I lived alone when I was in Prague to be away from the company. It was all completely focused. I think the biggest mistake I made, if you can call it a mistake, is expecting to, from that point, do that kind of work for the rest of my life in film. That's kind of naive.
Well, what was the silliest script you got after winning the Oscar?
Oh, gee, there were so many that I refused. I should have done them just for the money, if not anything else. But they were just silly. They made me out to be a villain. I don't think Salieri is a villain. I think he's a real human being.
Well, Carl Malden said bad guys don't wake up thinking they're bad guys. They got a job to do.
That good old Carl Malden. I just saw One Eyed Jacks not long ago. He was
good in that. Yeah, I just watched Baby Doll. Not a film to watch with your wife, but
that's another good performance. Was that Kazan?
Yes. It's funny you mentioned intensity. My daughter, she's 7, and she said you were intense in Muppets from Space.
Isn't that great?
She's like, you're talking to him? I went, yes, that's part of Daddy's job,
oh,
believe it or not.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
That's so flattering. Isn't that a great age?
Yeah. She's. It's funny. My wife is an actress, and any role that my wife plays, my daughter wants to play. So she refers to herself as Baby Gertrude and Baby Parthy. And last year, Lynn got to do Lear, and Emma said, I'm Baby Goneril. And we went, no, you're not. No, no, no. That's wrong, and on so many levels. Yeah, don't give her any. I directed that, but she doesn't remember, thank God.
You're an actor.
I try. My wife is equity. I'm independent. And if it's a choice
Good.
Between my wife's guaranteed equity money and or my vanity projects, I let the missus work.
Works the work. So. I mean, you can see that for some of the films I've done. I mean, after a while, you think, well, I'm not going to wait anymore for a good film. I've got to make the rent.
Well, even
after a while, you think, oh, God, do I have to do this? And you do.
But
you
I think even films that are, maybe there's not high-profile roles, but when I see you in something like Insurrection and Surviving the Game, I'm like, well, he's going to be fine. He knows what he's doing.
Well, I love the idea of people asking me, like, well, why are you doing those movies? Well, that's kind of a dumb question. I mean, you do what you have to do. But if they ask me to do other films, I would do them. But it seems to me that my life is really revolves around the theater here in New York, and I do films when I have a break from the theater,
as opposed to the other way around.
Yeah, but it's a nice life. Mm-hmm. Just one of those. I love Shakespeare, and you can't live on Shakespeare, not in New York anyway. I don't think you can anywhere. I mean, I don't think they pay very well.
Mm-hmm. Was it after Amadeus that you wound up doing a lot more classical theater?
Oh, yeah, I was doing it before, but afterwards it was amazing how it kind of guarantees your work life. It's hard to believe. I mean, I'm a good actor, but there are a lot of good actors around. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not selling myself short, but you know what I'm talking about. You got to have some luck in this business.
Sure.
And I've had some luck, but. Ever since I won the Academy Award, I've been working practically every day. It's just been wonderful stuff off-Broadway, off-Broadway, experimental stuff with Richard Foreman and with Tom O'Horgan and, gosh, I guess everybody in town. I've really had a great time.
You still do.
I'm going to continue having a great time.
Well, it seems like it's been, from an artist standpoint, to be able to do stage and screen and voiceover and narration, so you're not stuck in a rut. You're not stuck doing a soap or a sitcom for years and years and years.
Yeah, it's the best.
And one of the things that's always been was cool for me, especially after seeing Amadeus, was you were one of those that guys. And when I saw your earlier work, I'm like, oh, my – I was a caffeinated 15-year-old. So I'm like, oh, it's the Amadeus dude. And – Scarface and Serpico and the Sunshine Boys. It was one of those, I have to go back, and this is before the internet, I'm like, I have to go back and find out what else this guy has done to lead up to this.
Oh, you got to take a look at the Ritz.
Yes, I saw the Ritz at too young of an age.
I should
revisit it again now that I'm more semi-mature.
Well, it works better on the stage, I think, but it's not a bad picture. Reed is great.
Yes. And I especially liked your work in Mighty Aphrodite.
Oh, thanks. That was fun.
Yeah.
I'm sorry you couldn't have seen any of my stage work, though, because I...
Well, you're still doing some stage work, right? I just need to go east.
Yeah. I've been doing Ethan Coen's plays. Those are pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know anything about them.
What are some of the plays?
Well, he's written 6 plays, and I've been in 4 of them.
So you're one of the community players.
They're 6 one-acts, short pieces, and it seems like we've got a hookup, and it's great because they're funny and they're brief and they're... What did Chekhov call his one-act plays? Vaudevilles? That's kind of what these are.
Right. Now, did I see you just completed a picture of Barbarossa?
Yeah, it should be coming out next month.
This isn't a remake of the Gary Busey, Willie Nelson Western, right? This is completely different?
Gosh, I didn't know about that.
1982.
No, I don't know that picture. I know Gary. We worked together.
Mm-hmm.
In Surviving the Game.
Yes.
We really had a good time, he and I. I mean, you've heard stories about him, and I...
Yeah, we've seen him on TV, yeah.
I didn't see any of that stuff. I mean, we had a great time. We became quite close.
I mean, the guy doesn't get an Academy Award nomination for nothing.
Well, that was a wonderful performance.
Yes. What is this Barbarossa about?
It's a historic character who actually tried to unify... Italy, but under his command, Barbarossa came in from the north and tried to take it over. And it's this heroic story of a stand that these farmers made against this brilliant and great general, and these Italian farmers won. It's a historically in Italy, it was a great moment in their history.
And you shot it in Italy?
Yes, I do a lot of in Romania, in Italy. I do a lot of work with the Italians. I've been doing it for ever since before Amadeus, actually. It's kind of my second home.
And you got the...
this picture I'm doing now is part Italian. It's Italian and Canadian financed.
This one is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The one I'm working on. Oh. And Barbarossa was strictly Italian.
Oh, I see.
Well, and that was the fifth film I made with that director. And I'm going to make another one with him next year in Italy and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
That, too, is a co-production between Canada and Italy. Don't ask me the connection, but there it is.
It's all right. I remember going, my family and I went to Stratford, and there was the Canadian Chinese restaurant. Whatever it takes. What's the picture you're working on now?
This is Giancarlo Giannini, and I are old friends.
Ah.
He wrote this script for us, and he's starring in it and directing it as well, and we're shooting it just outside of Toronto. I'm in town for only about 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
I had a break, and I came here to be with the family. But we're shooting up there, and then when we finish up in Toronto, we'll go back to Rome and finish up there.
I have
to be done with the picture on the end of October.
What's the title?
There's several titles. It feels a little like Woody Allen, the X Project.
Or untitled Woody Allen.
It's called Looking in Obituaries.
Yeah, it's going to be renamed in the States.
It's a good script. He did well. He wrote it, too.
Cool.
Yeah, he's a good guy. He's an inventor, too, by the way. Anyway.
What did he invent?
He is an electronic genius.
Really?
He does inventions for his own house, for his own sound system. And it's a remarkable man. He really is, aside from being a remarkable ladies' man. They just fall over their feet when they see him. He's had a wonderful career. His work with Lena was just sensational.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Britt Mueller.
Yes.
I worked with her on a picture that she wrote.
What was the picture?
It was called, enough about romance, now let's have some sausages. I mean, that's what she writes. But it was, my co-star was Sophia Loren.
Uh-huh.
And she played my wife, Lover, and I got to kiss her a lot of times.
Wow. You wish Kubrick was directing that day.
Yeah.
Take 130.
I don't know if I understand Kubrick's last flick. I was very disappointed, and I'm a real big fan.
Eyes Wide Shut? I was with it until the third Last Warning.
I just thought this is becoming predictable and dull. And he's never dull.
No.
His early stuff is still great. The Killing is still
love the
great
Killing.
Picture.
It's so funny when people, I show that to people, and I think they're used to the wide, huge, you know, almost bleak scope of something like The Shining in 2001, but The Killing is so good.
Yeah.
Great heist film. Now you got me thinking of Sterling Hayden, and I'm interviewing you.
Sterling Hayden, wow. Continues to churn it out, doesn't he? Mm,
always timeless work. It was funny,
have you seen my wife discovered it recently, the original upon which, speaking of Sterling Hayden, Airplane was based?
In
the Zone, or what was it?
I thought there were a couple.
Zero Hour,
yes.
Have you seen it?
Not in a long time.
Oh, man, it's so funny.
So the Zuckers really were taking notes watching that.
No, they were lifting lines. The names are the same, too.
Oh, really?
At one point, Sterling Hayden say, it's a fine time to quit smoking. That was his line originally. And he's very serious. I mean, of course, they're all very serious. But it's great. I mean, you got to see it.
I'll look for it because it was funny. That was 1980 when the Airplane came out.
Oh, that couldn't have been that late.
Really? No, Airplane. Yeah.
Oh, Airplane. Yeah.
Yeah, Airplane. But what I mean was you had all these serious actors like Leslie Nielsen and Lloyd Bridges and Robert Stack, and they were able to get a second wind of their careers doing that stuff.
Well, they were willing to make fun of themselves. I thought that was very bold. And also the credit goes to the director for making them feel they can get away with it, I think. That was they were wonderful. Bridges was sensational.
Yep.
But there was another line, the doctor on the plane. It was legitimate. It was so funny.
I speak jive, no.
You have to find a doctor, but a doctor who didn't eat fish.
Oh, right.
It's a real. It's an honest to God. Anyway.
Hey, let's not. Hey, let's not forget about your tongue work in Loaded Weapon One.
That could have been better. Anyway, that's always fun.
A few months ago, I actually found on DVD and bought and watched again Name of the Rose.
Ah, yeah.
Very scary in that, you are.
6 months shooting. Sean was terrific.
And that was your first of two times working with Sean.
Yeah, he's a good guy. At least he was with me anyway.
That's good.
Yeah, we got along very well. I usually have trouble with anyone, but, you know, you can't get along with everyone.
Mm-mm.
Some people are impossible, and we won't even go into who they are. Okay?
I would never ask that. That's not this type. This is not that type of program.
Yeah.
Just one film fan to another.
I just don't understand why we can't make better films. I really don't. I mean, we've got all these examples for the last, I don't know how many years now. There's no excuse for this crap. You know, there really isn't. There's just no respect for the word, I think, and that's what the problem is. Enough of this slice-of-life action crap. Let's get some art back into it. You know, those wonderful moments when you hear a theme or you see even a few frames of a picture and you go, I want to watch this again. I mm-hmm. can't wait to see this movie again. That's the kind of movie that we can still make. I mean, the idea that you have to spend $200 million for a picture and you still can't make anything but trash, it's absurd.
Do you get a lot of offers from, say, independent directors?
Well, I get them. It's just that even that, they're not very good. I'd love to work for Del Toro, for example.
Ooh.
He and I got along very well on Mimic. Mm-hmm. And we made promises, and I'm from the border of Mexico, and we both speak Spanish, and I just haven't heard from him. So I'm sure when something comes up, he'll call me, because he's a sincere man. But I think he's terrific, and he started out as an independent. What was that wonderful story from Buñuel when he was approached? Do you remember that picture that Woody Allen made where they're standing in line and he talks, they're having an argument?
Annie Hall.
And Marshall McLuhan.
Marshall McLuhan is back behind the plant, If Life Were Only Like This.
Yes, well, he originally wanted Buñuel to do that.
Oh, really?
And it was going to be a different conversation, but it was going to... And he offered, you know, he offers everyone the same money, take it or leave it. But for Buñuel, who said, I can't do it, I'm busy, I'm working. And he said, well, I'll give you such and such amount of money. And he went up to $30,000, and which is outrageous for Woody Allen to offer.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a wealth of money for him to offer. And Buñuel still said, I really can't do it. And then he reflected and said, that was more money than my last film cost me to make. $30,000. Well, he was shooting in Mexico at the time. But
sure.
The point is, it doesn't have to be an expensive film to be a good one. You need a script. You need some good actors. And if you got a good script, you're going to get the actors.
Mm-hmm.
You get me just in a second. But anyhow, you do work for free. I mean, my theater work is practically, I have to underwrite it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Theater doesn't pay.
Oh, we know about underwriting here. This interview,
you know very well what I'm talking about.
This interview is made possible by memberships like yours. Thank you.
Love. I got no complaints. But I really think that, as I said before, I've got a lot of friends in this business, long, long lived friends who are just brilliant actors with all these chops, and they can't get arrested. I have to keep reminding them and myself what luck means in our lives. And I'm a very proud actor. I love my profession, but I'm also full of humility. I'm constantly grateful for these breaks I've been getting. And I'm absolutely sincere when I tell you that.
Well, I looking back at even the film work, there doesn't seem to be anything that is embarrassing. And I've seen people with lots of money and lots of acclaim, and they do something that's just... It's just downright silly and not in a complimentary way. And that I don't think it's ever happened with you.
Keep talking. Listen, you're very nice. Thank you so much for this.
From 2009, my conversation with Academy Award-winning actor F. Murray Abraham, because I have archives and I'm not afraid to use them. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!